Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look at the issue of equality between men and women. In part two of today's program, a look at a children's book that celebrates mistakes. Stay with us. We're going to be talking for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show about women's equality, about the way in which this issue has sometimes shunted off to the side, perhaps in a way that it should not be, that in fact there is a pressing need to address this this concern aggressively and with great honesty. And that's certainly the contention of Carlin McDonald, who has written a book called The Every Woman's Guide to Equality, How Achieving Real Equality Will Change Women's Lives Forever. Carlin McDonald has had the really interesting experience of working in more than one field of endeavor that one might consider non-traditional or maybe slightly unconventional for women. And probably in part because of that, she has found herself on numerous occasions being subject to treatment that she really found inappropriate and offensive, sometimes verging on or maybe being out-and-out discrimination and even sexual harassment. And her concerns have only mounted over the years as she's reflected on her own experiences and those of other women in other kinds of workplaces, and has finally prompted her to not only form an organization, but to address issues of women's equality, but also to write this book in which she spells out some of her concerns and some of her thoughts on how this concern can be best addressed. It's published by Change in Our Lifetime Press. Again, the book is called The Every Woman's Guide to Equality, How Achieving Real Equality Will Change Women's Lives Forever. And Carlin McDonald, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. You talk about how you believe this issue is not really being addressed, that in some ways it seems to be superseded by other concerns, and maybe too many people are making blithe assumptions that the situation for women is better than it is. What do you attribute that to, the fact that that people are not, to the same extent at least, talking about women's equality and women's issues in the same way that maybe they were actually a couple of decades ago?
I've heard that quite a bit, actually, from people who say to me, well, it's gotten better, hasn't it? Why isn't that enough? And I always say, getting better isn't getting it done. Women still, you know, face pay inequality. They face inequality in healthcare provision. you know, violence against women in this country is a national, truly disaster. And I'm not really sure why people aren't paying attention to it. I'm not sure if they don't understand how all-encompassing inequality is for women in this country, or they're, you know, beaten down so much from listening to all the negativity in our media and our government officials that they just don't really know if there's anything that can be done. I really don't know what the answer to that question is. I can only say that my goal is to educate women about how I feel we are unequal in this country in a variety of ways, and try to show them in real numbers that my, you know, suppositions are in fact real.
Let's have you talk a little bit about your own experience in the workplace. As I touched on in the introduction, you have worked for quite a few years in a couple of different fields that one might consider to be at least mildly unconventional for a woman. explain to our listeners the kind of work that you have done and the kind of experiences that you have had that have only heightened your concerns about issues of equality.
Well, when I was a college student, I was a marine biology major, and a part-time job I had was working for a company that performed surveys on ships. When they would come in to port with cargo, what kind of, you know, wheat or corn or cotton or whatever, or they would go out, we would go in and sample the material that was being shipped, as well as measure the draft of the ship, how low it sits in the water, how high it sits in the water, and the condition of the holds. And it was kind of interesting and you know, different. And one ship we boarded escorted us off because they said, no prostitutes, no prostitutes. And we, of course, were dressed in work boots, hard hats, you know, coveralls. And so it was kind of obvious to us at that point that pretty much the only women that were ever came on those ships were, you know, working women in the, you know, prostitutes. And so when our boss came, you know, he explained to them that we were working for him, and everything was fine. But it was an interesting take on, you know, what women were thought of at that point. And also when you were working, when we were working on the ships, and there were, you know, stevedores loading or unloading, they were not friendly or complimentary about women on the ship or on the docks at all. And I like to say I learned language to describe women that I wish I'd never learned back then. And but, you know, it bothered me, but the work was so interesting I kind of ignored it because it wasn't as in my face as other experiences. When I worked on an East Coast railroad, I did environmental work there, and I came across a heavily contaminated rail yard, and I had to work in a trailer with a bunch of the guys who'd been working in that yard. And there were pictures on the wall that were extremely graphic of women. And I was, you know, a little taken aback and more than a little offended. And I said, hey, can we take these down? And they were like, you know, suck it up. If you're going to work here, you got to work here. So I went out and bought myself a centerfold that appealed to me. And you know, hung it on the wall over where I would be working, and needless to say, very shortly after everyone showed up, all the centerfolds came down. So I felt a slight victory there, but it was like that all the time. It was a constant battle. You know, I had to battle with my boss to prove that I was doing, you know, a really great job, and I thought I was doing a really great job. And it was just a, you know, I always say they wanted me to wear work boots in the field and a hoop skirt and parasol in the office. And so they kind of clash when you think about what your job is supposed to be. And also the fact that quite a few of the men that were in managerial positions, whatever, had wives that were working at home, mothers, and weren't really sure that I belonged in the workforce, that maybe I should be at home, having children and, you know, staying at home and working hard there. And so that was a... it was an interesting experience.
One of the things I find interesting as you describe some of these experiences in the workplace is that you're very careful to acknowledge that some of your bosses have been pretty good bosses.
Awesome.
In other words, you know, you're not painting with just a broad brush of every man I've ever worked with has been a creep or whatever. I mean, you're very careful to say that you know, at least some of the people for whom you've worked have been you know, good guys who treated you well. That being said, I suspect that you wish maybe that some of those bosses had been maybe more aggressive when it came to safeguarding the way you were treated by, you know, your fellow employees, and maybe doing even more to create an overall work environment that would be more positive and more equitable.
I think that's a very good statement. First of all, let me say that my book isn't about bashing men. I always say that men are, we'll get to them next. Right now, women need to clean their own house. We need to come together as a group. We need to believe that we deserve equality. We need to say, hey, we're not going to settle for this kind of behavior. We're not willing to accept this anymore. And I think once women come together as the over 50% we are in this country group, then negotiating for ourselves becomes easier because we come from a position of power. I also say in my book that I really do believe there should be a no-tolerance policy in corporations for behavior, and I mean any kind of behavior, so sexual harassment or even jokes that are not funny. And there's a line between what's funny and what's not funny. You know, people like to write off the feminist movement or the equality movement as a bunch of angry women. And really, it's a bunch of women who believe that we should be getting fair pay for fair work, same experience, same qualifications. We should be being paid the same. We should be able to have excellent medical care or equal to what a man is having. Our symptoms and our health should be just as important, should be just as researched, should be just as studied as men. So there should be no differentiation between male and female in the sense of equality. And, you know, that's when people write off the movement or write off the women's demands for equality or equal pay, then, you know, it's just it's ignoring what the real facts are of what we're trying to accomplish.
When,
and frankly, if I was working at the same job you were doing with the same experience and you were making more than I was, I would be a little angry.
Understandably so.
Right?
I think many of the essential points made in your book make perfect sense even at a glance. But one of the interesting points you make that I think only makes sense once you kind of look a little closer at it is the second chapter of the book, which is titled "Our Story is Young." Yeah, I mean, we just, as we first read those words, we aren't necessarily certain. I mean, whose story are we talking about, and what do you mean by it being a young story, and so on. And, of course, we begin reading, and we see that the story, in a sense of women's equality, you are saying, is a very young story. And I wonder if you would explain to our listeners why you think that's an important point to make. How does that help us along in terms of a greater understanding and sensitivity to this whole issue of women's equality? Explain the significance of this being, in a sense, a young story.
I think it's really important to understand your history, whether it's your personal history. In women's, the case of women, we are talking about less than 100 years of having achieved the right to vote. And that will be in 2020. We'll celebrate 100 years of women, you know, and I like that people get unhappy when I say this, being given the right to vote. We had no representation in Congress at the time. And I think that knowing our history is really important. Where we've come from, if you don't understand what we've achieved or what we've fought for or what we've struggled for, we really don't have a handle on where we're going. We don't need to create, you know, recreate the wheel every time. And in this election, it's interesting because you find, you know, younger women, you know, pitting themselves in some ways against women who've been, you know, active and around, you know, kind of calling out women who've been active and around for a while, you know, outdated and all this other stuff. And I think that's unfortunate because history is really important. I think that what women have available to them now in the workplace or the choices that they can make today versus what they could make in the 30s or 40s are because the women have worked so hard, and men, to achieve equality. The, you know, mothers of the 70s who fought very hard for, you know, feminism and equality have given us all these great opportunities today. And it's really picking up that mantle and carrying it forward. But not to say, oh, hey, everything that happened before us doesn't matter anymore. That's, you know, from here forward is all that's important. And that's why I talk about women's history being young, because if you look at some of the firsts that women have achieved in our society, it's, you know, really not very long. And I always say it's our right to vote is less than a person dreams of a lifetime, which is 100 years. We all want to live to be 100, I guess. And so it's less than 100 years old.
Right. I think you are stepping into delicate territory in the third chapter of the book called We Need to Be Together, in which you are arguing, and I think persuasively, that in order to really make significant strides, I mean, beyond what have been made already, it is important for women to come together in much more sort of wholesale fashion than has maybe been the case, that there have been too many divisions within womanhood itself to allow for sort of the greatest progress that otherwise might be made. Just explain to our listeners what you think the most significant divisions are and your strategies for overcoming those divisions.
I think this is really the toughest nut to crack, because women are so vested in being, you know, a short woman, a lesbian woman, a African-American or black woman, a Hispanic woman, a Jewish woman, a Muslim woman, a Christian woman. It's almost a hyphenated, you know, name for us. I'm a this woman rather than I'm a woman. I feel that if we can take all of our, you know, qualifications, our subdivisions, our categorizations, and just stop for 1 second. I'm not asking people to forget who they are. I'm not asking people to downplay who they are. I'm asking people, women, to remember that the most common denominator we have is that we are women, and that as we continue to segregate ourselves in our groups, you know, liberal women, conservative women, Democratic women, we split up our ability to achieve a common goal, because we are no longer working as a team, as a group. We're working individually within our own groups. I find this when we talk about domestic violence, which is just an incredible epidemic in this country. I find this when we're talking about, you know, child trafficking, human trafficking. I find this because there are so many groups out there that are doing these things, and I think you're accomplishing something that's great, but you're accomplishing 1% or 4% or 7%. And if you all came together as one group and could put aside the infighting and the ideas of what you think you should personally achieve from this, we could do a lot to change the world. But we're not, because we're, you know, we're separating ourselves out.
I'm speaking with Carlin McDonald about her book, The Every Woman's Guide to Equality, How Achieving Real Equality Will Change Women's Lives Forever. You devote an entire chapter towards healthcare bias. And this is obviously a concern of paramount importance to you and to other women. Just explain a couple of the ways in which you have seen this or experienced this yourself.
Well, I go back to that aspirin study. 10,000 men, zero women. When they did the aspirin study to determine aspirin and cardiovascular health. So right there, it says, oh, hey, by the way, women are not important, all right? In 1993, the FDA put out guidelines, you know, saying, hey, you know, we need to start to acknowledge women in our studies, that there's difference in, you know, how women react to pharmaceuticals, et cetera. Please include more women in your studies. In 2013, the FDA recommended cutting in half the dose of a very popular help you sleep drug, because the dosing for women at that same level as men was not good. So now you're looking at 1993 was when the guidelines came out, right? And 2013, so we're talking 20 years later. This is, so we're still talking about women not being included enough in drug trials and research. So that's a huge problem because everybody has to take some kind of medicine at some point. And my question always is, did you ask your doctor whether or not, or your pharmacist, because pharmacists are amazing, you know, wealth of information for you. And is this okay for women? Are there any guidelines? Should I know something? That behavior translates into the medical community, into your doctors and dentists and therapists, because if the stage is set for women to be considered not as important in drug trials or whatever, it translates over to not as important in healthcare overall. And I'm not, you know, saying that every doctor out there is, you know, anti-woman, or I'm not saying any of that. I'm saying that studies have shown that women are treated less aggressively for heart disease, that their symptoms are sometimes ignored or written off as, you know, emotional symptoms. So many young women were told that, you know, cramps from their periods were, you know, in their head. And, you know, Valium used to be a very popular drug in the 70s for the unhappy mother, unhappy wife. So I just want to see doctors looking at their patients as people and saying, okay, person A has heart disease and she's got, person A has blah, 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 and we're going to treat this way. So if that you're treating poorly, you're treating all your patients poorly. Hmm. And then when you start talking about, you know, I'm going to, reproductive health in this country, it's very sad to me because we've allowed that conversation to become only about abortion and nothing more about what a woman needs to have, about cervical cancer, ovarian cancer. You know, reproductive health in this country is more than a one-dimension discussion. And every time we start to have a discussion about Planned Parenthood, for example, or women's reproduction, we talk about abortion, and then everything stops talking. And we can't talk about the benefits of having women having access to health care who are poor or who have no money or who have no opportunity ever to see a doctor. And that is a really big thing for me.
Hmm. In the sixth chapter of the book, which brings us back to various issues of workplace inequality, you make an intriguing point that I would love to have you just explain a bit, and that is that you have a lot of trouble with the notion of, or the concept of, or the term unconscious bias.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, the term would be, is, I think most people, when they use it, are referring to the fact that someone without conscious thought is, in fact, engaging in discriminatory or exclusionary behavior, but not consciously thinking, I don't want a woman for this job, or I don't want a woman to be my colleague, but on a sort of lower mental level, those kind of biases are at play. And some people would argue that it's important to talk about that kind of discrimination in order to properly address it. But you really are not comfortable with that terminology and that concept. I'd like you to explain why.
Well, my feeling, okay, so if you take my position that companies just need to create no-tolerance policies, so if you act inappropriately, if you steal from your company or you sexually harass a woman, you're fired. You're fired, right? These are all equally, punishable offenses at work, that there should be such a strict code of ethics and behavior at every corporation that nobody will feel comfortable crossing the line into sexual harassment. Okay? Having said that, so unconscious bias to me is, I've been called out. I was called out by somebody who reviewed my book as not understanding it, which I think is, okay, a legitimate concern, but I do understand it. And here's my problem with it. It's another, to me, time-wasting endeavor to try to get people to see that they might, you know, not like somebody who's female or black or Hispanic or gay, but, and it's unconscious. I don't care about what you think unconsciously. I don't care about any of that. I think when you're in the workforce, you're conscious. You look at somebody and decide you don't want to hire her or you don't want to hire him. She might go work for you 2 years and then have a baby. So these are things that you're thinking consciously. There is no way anyone can tell me otherwise. I've interviewed and hired people. And you're looking for more than what's on paper. And if a male finds himself sexually attracted to a woman he's interviewing, the chances might be that he'll either hire her for reasons other than her qualifications, or he won't hire her at all because he's concerned about that attraction. So I believe conscious bias is something we should be talking about. Microsoft is a great example. Microsoft has a whole big unconscious bias department, right? And I believe it was their CEO said that good karma, this is the last few years, good karma is women, you know, being patient for a raise. Now, that's just utter stupidity, but okay, maybe that's unconscious bias. But it came out of his mouth, so on some level, if he's not conscious that he said that, I mean, that's a travesty to me. But just recently at the Xbox meeting, they had women dressed in skimpy little bra tops and Catholic schoolgirl outfits. And there were a lot of Twitter comments from women there and men who were like, yeah, great, this is a great thing. Because it's, you know, it's objectifying women. And I think if they'd had men dressed in little tiny G-strings running around with those women, then it might have been a more equitable display. But having said that, this is Microsoft. That is a huge unconscious bias, you know, effort. And here is behavior that somebody was conscious about. So I can't reconcile unconscious bias in my mind as anything that I just think it's another waste of time. People will disagree with me completely. I think it's a waste of time. I think it doesn't matter what people think unconsciously. I think people, what matters is how they act consciously and standards in place at every corporation, organization, government that prevent any subjective behavior, if possible.
Your book includes all kinds of suggestions for particularly what women can do to sort of stake a proper claim for being treated equitably and fairly. And a lot of suggestions that might not even necessarily occur to people on their own. So you've obviously given this a whole lot of thought and thought beyond the obvious in terms of what people can do and say in order to really make positive differences in this regard. At one point in this same chapter called Do Something, Make a Difference, you say, be a positive, uplifting person. I mean, that is one component in your advice for I think you're talking maybe particularly to women, and obviously you feel some kind of concern that along the way, as women are working for equality, that it's also important to be positive and uplifting. I'm curious to know what in particular prompted you to include this in this chapter.
I mean, I think every morning when you get out of bed, you make a decision about how you're going to face the day. You can either face it grumpily, which we all do, or you can say, you know what, I'm taking a breath, I'm lucky, let's see what the whole day holds. And I think that empowering each other is really important. I have never been somebody who looks at somebody and is envious or jealous of that person's achievements or, you know, looks or whatever, because I am who I am, and there's nothing I can do about that. I can't, you know, change what I have, and to longingly, you know, yearn for something that is not going to happen is, you know, the road to displeasure and unhappiness. And that's not to say that I don't, you know, I'm not unhappy or unpleasant at times. I'm sure, I know I am. But I always think that if people are uplifting to each other and positive to each other and complimentary to each other to make people each other feel better, it puts us in such a more positive frame of mind, and it creates camaraderie. And that's really what women have to do. We have to develop camaraderie with each other. We don't have to be alike. We don't have to believe the same things. We don't have to eat the same foods or even look alike. But it's kind of like a sisterhood. without all the negative connotations of sisterhood. And I just think that, you know, embracing a more positive outlook, you know, yes, we're working hard to achieve equality, and yes, it's difficult, and yes, we have politicians who are saying stupid things like, you know, legitimate rape, and or holding hearings on women's health where no women are welcome. Those are just things, you know, I mean, can you look at that negatively? Yes. I call that, for me, that's a rallying cry, to work harder, to try to reach more women and men, to see that equality is really important for themselves, for their daughters, their mothers or sisters. And so if we can throw, you know, some uplifting behavior in there, it doesn't become a drudge. It's a lot of hard work. I know that. There's a lot of hard work to achieve equality in this country, and every day we seem to be rolling backwards. But I do think that it can be done, and I do think if we come together, we can achieve great things. And as I say, the subtitle of the book, The Every Woman's Guide to Equality, how achieving equality will change women's lives forever. And I agree. I mean, that's really what I believe.
Hmm. I like how you say at one point, you suggest that we ask yourself every day what your responsibility to women's equality is. And you end the last chapter of the book with this idea that our quest for equality is fragile. It is young. It needs to be tended and watered and nurtured and loved. Be its gardener. You are calling for everybody who reads this book, in a sense, to be a gardener tending to that really, really important issue.
Yes, I am. And I say this, you know, this is not a book just for women. This is a book for men and women. Men need to understand the situation for women in this country. I think it's educational and eye-opening for people who read the book, especially women who think they know all about equality like I thought I was. I did until I wrote the book. And then I realized when you start to pick it apart piece by piece, there is an enormous amount of inequality for women in this country.
The book is The Every Woman's Guide to Equality, How Achieving Real Equality Will Change Women's Lives Forever, published by Change in Our Lifetime Press, the author Carlin McDonald. Carlin McDonald, thank you so much for writing this thought-provoking book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
A wonderful, colorful, intriguing, creatively crafted children's book has just crossed my desk. And this book is called Beautiful Oops. It is a book which celebrates mistakes and the way in which what would seem like an irreparable and entirely regrettable mistake can in fact be a blessing in disguise. And I am so excited to talk with the man responsible for this wonderful book. His name is Barney Salzberg. And if you have children's books on your shelf at home, maybe you know his best-selling book, Peekaboo Kisses, as well as last year's book called Good Egg, which is an interactive book. And Beautiful Oops is a book which is also something you have to sort of experience in person. It's a book you hold in your hands and in some respects manipulate to experience some of these mistakes and to see them before your eyes transformed into something wonderful and creative. And Barney Salzberg joins us for the next few minutes to talk about his wonderful book and his career in children's literature. This book, by the way, is published by Workman Publishing. Barney Salzberg, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
I'm especially excited about this because right down the road from our radio station at Carthage College is the Center for Children's Literature. And over the last several years, I've had the great pleasure of interviewing an array of people involved in the children's book industry. And I have come to, as someone who doesn't have kids himself, I've come to a much deeper understanding of the special challenges that are involved in this field. And so every time I have the chance to talk to someone who creates books for children, I do it with a kind of a new sense of appreciation for what you do. Has this always been what you wanted to do professionally?
For a really long time. My first children's book was published in 1981. So So this has been a lifelong project for me, a process for me, and something I've always loved. I actually found a children's book before I had kids, before I was married, and I was so intrigued with the artwork in it and realized after I bought it, just because I liked looking at it, that it had a great story. And that sort of sparked the idea that maybe I could do this. I had been a songwriter before that. Always loved playing with words, but writing a story was a daunting task. This book is a departure in that it really isn't a story per se, but it is an interactive experience in playing with what we think are mistakes. Hmm. It's a little different.
It's a wonderful book. I loved every page. Just talking for a moment again in more overarching way about your whole career. As you began doing this, I think some people enter this with not a full understanding of actually how tricky it is to craft good books for children. I mean, I think some people at least assume it to be a lot easier than in fact it is. I mean, I think they assume it would be a lot easier than writing a book for their own peers.
Right.
What were your expectations or fears and or confidences about what this would be like?
I think I was fairly clueless. I live in Los Angeles, and I teach a class once a year in writing and illustrating picture books at UCLA. And I'm in the middle of a class now, and it's fascinating because I've seen it over the years. People do come in and expect this to be easy. And I have in the description of my course that it is like writing a haiku. It's actually very difficult because every single word has to count. And if you start speaking down to a child, you've lost the game and your book falls apart. Your story doesn't become a book. It's very tricky. It really is. And how to captivate someone's attention. These are books that are read over and over and over again. And they really have to work, and there's a lot more involved. My wife is an attorney, and she watches me in this process and cannot figure out how I can possibly do this. It's a lot of work. A story that might take 3 minutes to read could take me anywhere up to 5 to 10 years to write. That's, don't translate that into dollars.
We're speaking with Barney Salzburg, and we are talking about the most recent of his many children's books, and this one is called Beautiful Oops. You know, it occurs to me, by the way, for those of us that kind of wonder about the future of books, that is physical books versus e-books, that probably one realm in which we're going to see real books maintain their foothold for a long time is in the realm of children's books, exactly because of books like this that you just have to hold in your hands.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, I do. I'm very well aware of it at this point in time. I think publishers are all looking around to see how this is going to impact our books. It's much different than translating a novel into a digital book, because every picture book is different. And is it going to talk to you? Is it going to move? Is it going to sing? Is it going to just be a flat book that you turn the pages? This is clearly something that needs more involvement because it is interactive.
Right. And reading it and experiencing it is a very tactile experience. Tell us where the initial idea came from.
Well, I travel around the country speaking to educators and to students, and two of the slides in my PowerPoint show how I fixed mistakes. I spilled coffee on a sketchbook. I always ask the kids, how many of you would want a new sketchbook if you had a stain like this? And they all raise their hand. And I show them that in the next picture, how I took that stain and drew a monster in it. Teachers have been saying, can't you get that across in a story? And I really didn't know if I could. And I kept trying it out in stories, and they felt too preachy to me. And one day I tore a piece of paper partway in half in my studio, realized that it looked like the mouth of an alligator, and I could, in fact, now start exploring what other mistakes, spilling things, tearing things, stains, smears, smudges, bending paper in a way that I wouldn't necessarily want. How could I then turn those around? And they all were unexpected challenges for me with really lovely results.
Wow. So that's literally what you did. I mean, this was a case of sort of trial and error and experimentation to come up with some of these other transformed mistakes.
Completely. I mean, even to the point that I crumbled up a piece of paper, as we've all done, in frustration of not making something the way we want, whether we're drawing a picture or writing a story. I guess that was more common when we had typewriters, but still the idea that you wad something up to throw it out. And I thought, to be true to the spirit of this book, there must be a way to integrate that rumpled up piece of paper into the book. And I made it into a sheep, and it worked.
It's so great. It's towards the very end of the book, and it's a great little aha moment. There are a lot of them in this book. Once you had sort of assembled the basic kind of mistakes that you wanted to see in the pages of the book, then what was the process like to go from initial ideas sketched on notebook paper or whatever to the finished reality of the book itself?
Well, I actually never made, when I do a picture book, I will write it and then make what's known as a storyboard, where I map out on one piece of paper a little thumbnail sketch as a book. This one, it was a much more hands-on process, and I didn't even know the order of it, other than the first one I ever did was the torn piece of paper, and that ended up being in the beginning of the book as well. But it was really a process of what could I do as far as activities that would lend themselves to the printed page. And once it was together, and I wrote something on each page, a torn piece of paper, it became as just the beginning. You know, every spill has lots and lots of possibilities. Those could really have been in any particular order. It summarized the end with the philosophy of the book, and it needed to wrap up and sort of be a culmination of all of the different things that had happened leading up to the end. I wanted to show how they would all look, creating one, actually what it becomes a three-page spread to end the book. And the line there is, when you think you've made a mistake, look at it as an opportunity to make something beautiful. And it sort of was a perfect way to end it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the nuts and bolts of this book being constructed, in terms of how one sort of creates these sort of pop-up effects of one kind or another. I mean, and are we talking about a whole team of people that make such a thing possible? I mean, how much were you specifically involved?
Well, what you're seeing in the book is what I turned in. That's what I gave them. I built that book.
Really?
Yeah. They were able to reproduce it, but I built it. I'm not a paper engineer. Lift the flap is a fairly basic concept to do. The biggest challenge was there's an accordion piece that pulls way out, and I had seen that same technique in another book, and I studied it and adapted it for my book, but I actually built one.
Hmm.
Theirs looks a little better than mine now that my publishers made it, but they knew what I was going for. It was a crude version of this, but there are very few publishers that could pull off a book like this. And Workman was my first choice, and my editor there, Raquel, just totally got this concept and ran with it. And not only does this look like my book dummy, which is what you call a book that you send in, but it was stunning. I mean, they pushed it and used wonderful paper and great ink process so that there's pieces that are shiny, there's pieces that are flat. I was knocked out when I saw it, and that doesn't happen a lot.
Right.
They really knew how to do it.
Yeah. So let's give our listeners just a little clearer idea of some of what they find in this book. So we open up the book. The title page, again, is Beautiful Oops. We flip to the first full spread, and there in big letters and sort of splattery letters is the word oops with a big exclamation point, and the opposite side is a tear in the sheet. It's a very thick page, but there's a big tear at the bottom, a torn piece of paper, and we turn the page, and what do we find?
It says it's just the beginning, and that tear on the reverse side has now become the mouth of a giant green alligator.
And it fits exactly perfectly to form that mouth. And with very few words and just this single image, you are inviting us to explore the rest of the book. There is one spread where we see bent paper, just those two big words, and sure enough, the top right-hand corner of the of the right page is folded down, and from that vantage point, it looks like a mistake. And we flip to the next spread, and what do we see?
Well, that page was flipped so the other way, so that when you're looking at the book, it's sort of just missing. That corner is missing. When you turn it, that little dog-eared piece has became the head of a penguin. We have three penguins holding hands, and it says pen paper is something to celebrate, and it felt like a happy picture, so that seemed like a perfect thing to call it.
Absolutely, with that little dog-eared page corner that helps to form the beak of the penguin, and of course that penguin is then by far the most vivid of the three that we see. We should mention to our listeners this moment in the book that involved that sort of accordion piece, which is especially beautiful and wonderful. And in the spread before, we read holes in your paper, and again we see on the right hand side a round hole right in the middle of the page. And then we flip, and you have the words, are worth exploring. And then what do we see? Try to describe this wonderful accordion piece to our listeners.
Well, it's a sort of a rectangle sandwiched piece of paper that's connected to other pieces when you pull it out, but there's a hole. And I had initially written, pull out and look inside. My editor felt people would figure it out. I have to sit on my hands when I watch adults read it, because most of them just pull it out and look at it from the side and go, that's nice. But when you do look through it, it's almost like looking through a telescope, and you're seeing different sheets as you look through it with different images on them, and you're looking all the way down to the bottom where there's a little character with a message, which is C-S-E-E, which is what I'm hoping you're doing and you see when you look at this book.
Absolutely. And again, from start to finish, it just has this wonderful sense of surprise about it. And sometimes we read such books and the surprise is very, very evident. And these surprises are very well hidden in a sense. And the product, obviously, a very fertile imagination. Before you turned this in, did you try it out on young young readers, or were you pretty certain that this was something that they were going to really enjoy?
This one I kind of got. I mean, I'm always forcing people who come over to look at what I'm working on, and it's funny. I actually, Jamie Lee Curtis is a friend of mine, not close, but we've bumped into each other over the years in Los Angeles, and she had just said, I'd love to get together. And when someone like that says, I want to get together, I followed through with that. And she was in my studio looking at my books that I was working on. And this book she found before I had sent it out. And she said, what is that? And we sat down, and luckily for me, she held onto my leg the entire time she read it and was squeezing it going, this book is going to change your life. She goes, I have goosebumps, and that's always a sign. And I knew I had something special with that response. It was just truly inspiring to see how she got this book and then offered this beautiful quote, which my publisher put on the cover. I was a little embarrassed. I thought they'd stick it on the back, but they were so taken with what she said that they put it on the front. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get sued here. But Jamie actually gave me her seal of approval and even came to the book signing when we launched the book in L.A.
Wow, yeah, this is someone who knows something about creating fine children's books. She says everyone who has ever said the word oops will be smiling when they see the masterpiece that Barney Salzberg has created. Funny and fun, beautiful oops is the best gift to give anyone, any age, anywhere, anytime. Yeah, endorsements don't come much more ringing than that one.
Well, yeah, and I've talked to people who have met her and asked her for endorsements, and she's passed. So I felt really honored, and to say what she said, I still get tingles hearing that. It was pretty much an honor, because I think she really, out of all the movie stars who are doing books, she knows what she's doing.
Absolutely.
She really does.
The book, again, is Beautiful Oops. It is published by Workman, and the man responsible for it, I was going to say, who wrote it. I mean, the words here don't matter. I mean, the words matter, of course, some, but what really matters is this as a whole, the words and the image and the idea, all of that from the fertile imagination of Barney Salzberg. Barney Salzberg, I so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about this wonderful book. Best wishes with all the books which you are yet to create.
Thank you for taking the time. It was really a pleasure talking to you.